Welcome to another podcast. This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
And I'm Keith Davis.
Our guest today is iconic, I think it's fairly safe to say. She's been on our television screens in the United Kingdom for as long as I can remember. She's been associated with organisations that have done extraordinary things. Should we do the big reveal? Our guest today is, Camilla?
Dame Esther Ranson. I know this is podcasting, but I have a picture in my mind of Dame Esther as a patron of umpteen charities who should be dripping in mink and diamonds because that's what patrons used to do. What I'm really interested in is, what does a modern patron do?
I think that's a very good point, because I think what she's done is she's almost moved through every role within charities, from the founder, then a trustee, to now being the president of a number of them. I think that unpacking that will be really exciting.
And fascinating to hear, Keith. At what point do you walk away? What kind of succession planning do you do? When you're the founder and it's your name, it must be tough.
Founders also have to perhaps just take a back seat every now and again and allow new thinking to come forward. You know, you can see the potential for clash in those sort of situations, can't you, really?
I just think her past actually shows a preparedness to reconfigure certain charities. And obviously the whole merger thing, I think, is really important. And how, as a founder, she's got her head around that to let go.
So it sounds like lots of meaty areas to get into with Dame Esther. And of course, we should also point out that she was way, way ahead of social media in pointing out that vegetables can sometimes look kind of funny.
Especially aubergines.
Aubergines?
I thought it was fennel.
There we go. We got the wonky veg thing out of the way really early on. Yeah. So we don't have to mention it for the rest of the podcast. Okay? Have we got that? Stay clear of the wonky veg.
Okay.
Let's get her in. Dame Esther Ranson was born into a family which was inclined to help others. Esther set up her first, let's call it, charitable endeavour when she was 15 years old, a theatre club that would put on comedies of manners in the local community. She then got a little bit distracted by a career in broadcasting. Working in BBC Radio, she famously provided sound effects on The Archers, all those gravel footsteps and squeaky five-barred gates. She then moved into the vastly inferior medium of television as a researcher reporter for Braden's Week, and then, in 1973, as the presenter of That's Life, which ran for 21 years on BBC television. She was, on that programme, a one-woman champion of rights, sound sense and the little person fighting bureaucracy. In 1986, Esther was making a BBC documentary called Child Watch, a programme about protecting at-risk children. The reaction was such that it led to the establishment of an anonymous phone helpline for kids and an organisation to provide that, Childline. In 2013, Esther built on that experience and set up the Silver Line, a free confidential telephone helpline offering information, friendship and advice to older people struggling with loneliness and isolation. Her journey with those charities is going to be the meat of what we talk about today. There will be no vegetables, we promise, wonky or otherwise. Dame Esther, thank you for joining us on Good Charity, Bad Charity.
Pleasure.
Let's start with that theatre club. That sense of wanting to do something for your local community. What was it all about?
Well, a group of us were very interested in drama. So I think, to be honest with you, it was an excuse to have fun. But I suppose the one that was really a revelation for me was when I was in my very early 20s. I was asked to help set up an organisation, which is running still, called Out and Abouts. And that was for disabled people living in the community to give them Tuesday afternoon tea and fun. I rapidly discovered as we went round organising transport for them that they were imprisoned. And it was an eye-opener. So I think the point about the voluntary sector, from my point of view, is that it reaches areas of society that often are invisible and inaudible and sometimes imprisoned through no fault of their own.
Where does that sense of wanting to help somebody else come from, do you think?
My mother was one of four daughters, all of whom did socially active jobs. I mean, one was a probation officer, one worked in a settlement in the East End, one was a volunteer working with a local psychiatric hospital, my mum working in a day nursery. So for some reason, all four women, and it was, you'll be astonished to hear, a matriarchy, all four women had a tremendous sense of responsibility to provide support and resources for other people. And I have sometimes wondered how far it helped being Jewish. Because if you are a member of a minority, and remember, I was born in 1940, so the Holocaust was very much part of my early childhood. And if you are a member of a minority, you recognize that you depend on the tolerance and generosity of the majority.
Camilla?
You are the patron of an amazing number of organizations. I'm really interested in, what does that look like for you? How do you decide what to say yes to? And how do you say no without alienating people that you will want to keep in the fold, shall we say?
My children say I don't know how to say no. The trouble is that I find the most seductive sentence in the world is, Esther, we need you. Even now, you know, there's a lovely little new charity of which I've suddenly become a patron of and a trustee of, which I adore.
Yeah.
Silver Stories. A very simple idea. New readers, people age 6 or 7, bring up older people who are on their own and read to them over the telephone.
And this works?
Both sides of that equation adore it. So we were just about to spread it around the UK when COVID struck. So we're working together to try and make that work. Now, two impossible seductions to avoid. One is, this is such a good idea. It sounds so simple, but clearly it's brilliant. And the other is, Esther, we need you.
But on that basis, then, Esther, you know, it's obviously nice to be needed. But you've come through from a founder to a trustee to a president, OK? You've done the whole roles there. How has that taken place? And what are the key things to be aware of for anyone that wants to follow your path?
I think the first thing I have always done, and this is in my professional career as well as my career as a volunteer, is know your limitations. So I made sure from the very beginning that I had a team around me of people who were good at the things I'm no good at.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Sometimes when I look at charities that fail, I wonder whether what they've done is surrounded themselves with kindred spirits who agree with them about everything. I mean, yes. I sometimes feel this way about government too.
Yes.
We'll get on to that.
Here, here.
You've got to have somebody who says, great idea, Esther, but actually we haven't got the money. Or, great idea, Esther, but actually we don't think it'll work because.
One thing I'm always intrigued by is someone involved in journalism, the sense that journalism and running charities, there are certain similarities. And you talked about spotting a good idea from a charity to you. In a way, there's the same instinct, journalistic instinct, spotting a good story, isn't it?
That is absolutely right. See, the kind of journalism that I've been associated with all my professional life has been solution-focused. A lot of journalism consists of investigating problems or swindles or scandals, and that's terribly important. But we on That's Life and other programmes I've made had an additional chapter, which was, okay, so that went wrong. Why did it go wrong? And how can we put things right so it doesn't go wrong again in the future for other people? And yeah, it's solution-focused. That very much applies to the voluntary sector because that's what they're there for.
And tell us a little bit about the moment when Childline, the documentary that you'd made, went out, that huge response you had to it.
I had just read a terrible story, the death of a toddler This body was found behind a locked door in a bedroom where she'd starved to death. And one of the background pieces, and I do believe it was in the Daily Mail, had said that her carers, her mother and her mother's partner, had met when they both attended the same special needs school. And I thought to myself, this is a family that needed support.
Yes.
Maybe the adults didn't recognise the danger of locking the little girl in a room for that length of time. And maybe there are other children who are equally vulnerable, only we don't know about them because, you know, it is under the radar. They are invisible.
Yeah.
So I said to the BBC, how about Child Watch? And how about basing our programme on a survey of That's Life viewers? Because That's Life, this programme that I'm sure you're much too young to remember, which had all kinds of vegetables and animals and all kinds of campaigns, was watched by a lot of children. So we said to our viewers, if you're a child and it's happening to you now, this is the helpline we're opening up for you after the programme. And it was after that show that I had my light bulb moment. I will never forget that Monday after the Sunday night. The programme went out. I went in on Monday morning and I met the two social workers who were in charge of the helpline, and they told me that the lines had been jammed all night with kids disclosing abuse for the first time. But they also said that by talking about it to someone who said they weren't to blame,
yes,
they should be protected, those children were empowered to ask for help. The team who were already setting up the Child Watch program called together a group of experts of all kinds, and we asked them if any of them, and there were various charities involved and government departments and so on, since this phone line had been so effective, we said, would you set up a phone line, especially for children, to report abuse? And they said two things. Children would use a helpline. They were unanimous that they would use it, but they were also unanimous that it would be impossible.
Why?
Because the demand would be too great. Because the challenges would be not only technical, but in terms of finding the funding. Now, my father had a very interesting asset, which I inherited from him, and it's called selective deafness.
Not amnesia, but deafness.
Deafness, yeah, go on. Yeah.
So I went selectively deaf, and I only heard the bit about children would use it, and I didn't hear the bit about, but it would be impossible. When I got in touch with BT, I was invited to meet the chairman. And I quoted one woman who said that when she was a child, she was never frightened of going home alone in the dark, of being raped or mugged, because she knew what was waiting for her at home was far worse than that could ever be.
Oh, God.
And I said to Sir George, you know, if we set up this helpline, the telephone itself could become a crucial instrument of child protection. And he said, how can I help? And I said, could we have a phone number so simple that even a six-year-old would remember it? And they gave us BT's engineering line, 0800-1111, which is the only number which has remained unchanged for 33 years.
Early, early.
Brilliant.
And on the night we launched on the Child Watch programme, we had 50,000 attempted calls.
Good Lord.
Really?
That's extraordinary.
Can I fast track that forward now then and sort of give a COVID link here? How has the demand been within COVID at the present moment in time?
Well, those experts that said it would be impossible were, of course, right. It is impossible for Childline to meet the demand. We do our very, very best. And because the way everything has changed in the last 33 years, 75% of our contacts from children and young people are now online. And COVID has made a difference, of course, because if you lock down, a lot of children find themselves imprisoned in unsafe homes, in homes where there's violence or addiction. And a lot of the contacts we've had were from children saying, I can't bear it anymore, I have to run away. So there has been an increase in demand. Yeah.
Can I not fast forward you? I'm more interested now in Silverline. With Childline, from what you've been saying, Dame Esther, the outcome is who you put that child in touch with, what sort of help that they get. Now, with Silverline, I get the impression the phone call, the contact, is in itself beneficial. Is that the end of the story?
When it comes to older people and the Silver Line, it is a different kind of conversation, because what are you going to do about somebody who is grieving because they've lost their husband or wife or partner, or their partner is with them but suffering from dementia? People who are so disabled, and a great number of the Silver Line callers are disabled, that they are sitting looking at the same four walls day after day. So whereas with children and young people, you could envisage a way to a brighter world, with some of the older people, the important thing you do is, first of all, listen to what they have to tell you, and then have a bit of fun.
Yeah.
Great.
Share memories, share some daft story, share something that isn't all doom and gloom. And yes, now we've joined Age UK, it's 3,000 or 4,000 befrienders making calls every week to people. And it really gives people something to look forward to.
A comment that I've read from you, and I'm sure it's accurate, is that there's a wide prejudice against older people. How do you, you know, did you come to that conclusion?
Well, really, just by launching the Silver Line. When we launched Childline, we were inundated with donations from the public. Mrs. Thatcher gave us a reception in Number 10. Princess Diana sent us a personal donation. And it seized the imagination of the nation that for the first time, children who were being abused behind closed doors were able themselves to ask for help. With the Silver Line, it was a much smaller audience. If you say old, or worse, elderly, to anyone in the media, they make for the hills. The money just didn't come in. We got a grant from Comic Relief. We got a 5-year grant from the Big Lottery Fund. We got a grant from the Postcode Lottery. But the great British public, no.
But how do you deal with the moment, as somebody who's set up a charity, when people are starting to say, no, I don't think I'm going to give you any money?
If you're going to try and raise money and spread awareness of a charity, you have to be resilient. You know, try and do everything you can not to get an adamant refusal.
Yeah. But it's a huge societal issue, isn't it? It's not just about people saying no to you. It's about people not even noticing that you're there. So invisibility is the thing you have to overcome before you can get to the person or the organization that funds you or will support you.
But, I mean, it is interesting, isn't it, that if you look at COVID, how long it took the government to notice care homes for older people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
We'll perhaps talk a little bit about growing those organisations, both Childline and Silver Line, and also just the challenges of COVID. I mean, very early on in the pandemic, Dame Esther, you talked, I think, to BBC Radio about the problems which were going to beset an awful lot of charities who relied on older people for their workforce. And if that older workforce was denied access to them because they were self-isolating or whatever, there was going to be a real hit. Tell us a little bit about how your overview now on what COVID has meant for the charity sector, and specifically the areas that you're involved with.
As you say, one of the unsung strengths and assets of the older population is the work they do in the voluntary sector. Mm. And we found in both the charities I know best, so many of our volunteer counsellors for Childline are 70 plus, and we had to ask them not to come in because we couldn't keep them safe in our bases. As I speak to you, for the first time in its history, Childline is not open 24/7. It's open until midnight and it starts again at 9. But, you know, this is terrible, because the calls and contacts we got, you know, at 3 a.m. were from children who were really desperate and in great danger. But we just couldn't get the staff and volunteers to keep the service going round the clock. It is everybody's ambition to reopen it as soon as we possibly can. So in terms of delivering the service and in terms of getting the money to pay for the service, I think the whole charitable sector has found it incredibly difficult. And I think some are having to close their doors, which is very sad.
I think that comes on to the point that you've obviously gone through the process of merging two of the big charities. But you also, I believe, but maybe I'm wrong, you actually support charities merging if it's right for the both of them.
Yeah, I think it has to be a merger between the right charities. I mean, it's like any marriage.
Yeah.
It doesn't always work. Almost inevitably, one partner charity is going to be bigger than the other. So what you're looking for is a bigger, more powerful charity that respects your work and doesn't just use you as an asset to strip your list of donors or whatever.
Yeah.
But we have to face facts in these tough times. I don't think either Childline or the Silver Lion would have survived on their own without having the strength of the bigger, longer established charities to underpin them.
Yeah.
And how do you go about that process of merger talks, if you like, and particularly, if you'll forgive me, with, you know, a forthright founder who's established a way of working, which for them is the vision. How do you then go about those tricky conversations with organisations who may have slightly different agendas, slightly different take on things?
Well, it's quite useful to have a loose cannon ricocheting around.
Is that how you define yourself? That's wonderful.
The story with the NSPCC was quite funny because I was invited to speak to a young president's association in Manchester. You know, these were the very bright young business leaders. And they, I knew, were supporting NSPCC. Childline was an independent charity, and I was invited to talk about Childline. And so I told them the truth, which was that we had 2 weeks worth running costs in unreserved funds in the bank.
Mm.
And the whole room went, The first question that someone put to me was, why aren't you run by the NSPCC? And I said, well, the NSPCC has got a helpline. It's for adults who are concerned about the safety of children. Childline does something a bit different because it's for children. So I went to our trustees board meeting very soon after, and I put the question to them, and they said, go and talk to the chair of the NSPCC. And 12 years earlier, our then CEO had said, no, no, we can't merge with them because we aren't strong enough and they will crush us. They won't mean to. But it will be like a mouse sleeping next to an elephant. The elephant turns over in its sleep and boom, we're flattened. So,
yes.
So 12 years earlier, it hadn't worked. This time, off I went to see Sir Christopher Kelly, who was chair of the trustees. So I said, Sir Christopher, I've just been to Manchester to talk to the young President's Association. He said, I know. He said, I've got a list of complaints here. Well, before we get on to the complaints, let me tell you what I told them. We have 2 weeks running costs in our unreserved funds. And he said, what? He said, you've got to survive. Our whole strategy is based on the fact that we don't have to create Childline because Childline already exists. Mm. To which I said, we may be the missing piece in your jigsaw. And in the end, we merge.
If I may, can we bring in Alex Scales, who's from the Centre for Charity Effectiveness here, because this is your absolute vision of the future, in a sense, isn't it, for a lot of charities? Mergers are a way forward.
Absolutely. And, you know, not appropriate for all charities by any stretch, but I think where that fit can be seen. I'd be really interested, Dame Esther, to hear, you know, what more can be done to encourage boards to think about merger as a sort of positive move, perhaps a little bit earlier on than when those, you know, unrestricted reserves are only sort of 2 weeks left or a little bit longer.
Right. The first thing that the smaller charity has to do is create a brand. You have to be seen as intrinsically valuable, not just as a series of debts. The public needs to know what you do. It's a big ask, but it's the public loyalty that protects you as a charity and makes another bigger charity respect your identity, your brand. And then I think the motive for a merger is probably financial. Mm. Because your executive will always say, but we do it better, you know. You know, there's this awful burning bush syndrome. You know how Moses thought the voice from the burning bush spoke only to him. And I think we in the voluntary sector suffer from this. Only we understand the real nature of the problem and know how to help those suffering. You know, we're the only people who can do it. It always worries me that.
Yeah.
Because you aren't the only person.
I think that's true. I like the way that you phrased that, because you talked about a positive brand. I think part of the problem, in my experience of the founders I've worked with at times, is they're not as flexible as they need to be.
Well, sometimes it's about blurring what's in the best interest of the organisation with blurring the best interests of those service users or the clients, isn't it? And I think one has to be quite forward-looking to see how not only client needs may change, but also how to maintain your relevance and ability to deliver.
Very soon after we set up Childline, I went on a rather strange but wonderful holiday to the Galapagos in a ship. All the other passengers seemed to be dentists and psychiatrists from Florida. You will gather from that it was not a cheap holiday. Anyway, yeah. I spoke to the psychiatrists about Childline, and one of them said to me, on day one, an organisation exists for the sake of its clients.
Yeah.
From day two, it exists to protect itself. I have always tried to keep my eye on the client, and I think when you get these terrible cover-ups in charities where abuse has occurred, people are so frightened of the damage that will be done to the organisation that they are prepared to go along with the crime. That is the terrible side effect of letting your gaze slip from your client.
Can I ask one last question? Government, do you think that there is a strong enough voice in government for the charity sector?
I think that we in the voluntary sector have to earn the public's loyalty and respect. Mm. And that will give us clout. I do, of course, worry when the public loses trust in us, because there have been well-publicised failures in the voluntary sector.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that means they stop funding us, they stop trusting us. I hope and pray that the voluntary sector will survive and survive well, because we are the ones that recognise needs, injustices, hardship that the rest of the world may be ignoring. We are the ones that provide the voice for the voiceless.
Dame Esther, there is nothing we can add to that. Thank you so much for joining us, for sharing your experience and your wisdom in the charity sector. It's been a pleasure to have you on. And we wish you well wherever you're going next.
And I can only say it's been fun.
Good, good,
good.
It's difficult to think of life without Dame Esther Ranson somehow, isn't it? She's one of those people who has just been there for so long, done so much stuff. Whether it is starting charities, exposing wrongdoings, or, dare I say, eating a kangaroo's testicle in the jungle. She's always been on our screens and in our minds. And I thought that was an amazing conversation. What do you think?
She demonstrated, in a way, remarkable restraint, because she refers to herself as a loose cannon. And she said every charity needs one. She's an incredible listener. And you can see how then she's probably an extremely good negotiator, because she knows what her position is as the loose cannon. She knows where her power lies, but she also listens and can play that back to whoever she's with.
Alex?
The organisations she set up are almost like challenger organisations in the business world. It's that entrepreneurial spirit. And then those organisations almost, you know, having discussions, perhaps at a little late stage with just 2 weeks of unrestricted reserves, one could argue. But, you know, to the bigger organisations and saying, you know, I've used my personal brand almost to get these to where they are. You know, now please take them forward so that they can reach many more people.
Keith?
For me, the whole power of that interview was phenomenal. Like Camilla, I was just so impressed that she thought on her feet and came out with what I think were lots of little golden nuggets that other charities can take away with them. Have the big team around you. You can't be everything to everybody.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Have resilience. And above all, have some fun.
Wasn't that extraordinary when she talked about Childline and the wave of need that was identified afterwards, and then the apathy of those organisations that didn't really want to take it on, too much of a hot potato. I thought that was amazing, really, and with the sort of belligerence of somebody who sees a story is determined to tell it to its maximum, she goes out and starts the organisation. I was very struck by that.
I'd hate to be a chairman or a chief exec of any charity, she says, I want to come and have a word with you. You know, scare you to death. You know, it's like, how can you say no to her?
We better sign off then. You've been listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
I'm Alex Scales.
And I'm Keith Davis.
We are delighted as ever with the support of the Centre for Charity Effectiveness. If you want to know more, there's our website, goodcharitybadcharity.com. Thanks to Dan Hardoon, our producer, to Whistle Down Productions, and we'll be back soon with more.